right now we have on the line with us Andrew Gosk. Andrew, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hey, it's good to have you back here on Radio Liberty. I've been reading your fascinating book, The Secret World of Money.
What do you think of it?
I think it's excellent. In fact, there are a lot of things in here I hadn't thought of before. Of course, I still remain a gold buff. In other words, I think if we ever want to have an independent currency, we have to have gold, because I don't trust any politicians. But I know you. We won't argue on what we're going to disagree on. I was fascinated to realize that there's something like $225 billion of U.S. currency circulating in Russia. That we are actually stabilizing the U.S. Pardon me, the Russian currency, because obviously the people over there don't trust their own money.
Absolutely, it's worse than that, though. You see, they needed propping up, and when our regime came to us and said we need to give the Russians $50 billion, the Americans rightfully had a fit. I think it's what I would have done, asked personally. So. They needed to do something in the back door, so to speak, and that's what really is the real key here, is how the money got to Russia, how that $220 billion got there.
Well, we'll talk about all of these things. First of all, for our listener, Andrew Goss is actually has a... Well, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself so that they'll know who you are.
Okay.
We've talked to you before, but our listeners may not know who you are and what you do and by what authority you write a book. But I will tell our listeners it's a fascinating little book, and we'll tell you probably later on how you can get copies of it if you want to. But Andrew has done a lot of thinking about money, creation of money, the sort of monetary system we should have. And I think you'll find this going to be a fascinating, fascinating hour. Why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself?
I guess the best way to describe it is that I started out trying to cash a silver certificate.
Of course, people don't even know what a silver certificate is. Aren't all certificates put out of Federal Reserve notes? So anyway, you go ahead and tell your story, and then we'll get so people can understand how we got from where we were with a solid currency to where we are today with a currency that's worth every bit as much as the paper is written on.
That's right. Yeah, I discovered that rudely. To everyone who says that the government doesn't repudiate its paper, that the silver certificate, which purportedly held, was a certificate for a dollar in silver, kept for me in the Treasury of the United States and payable on my demand, well, it frankly wasn't there. And it sent me into a search for what the difference was between a silver certificate and a Federal Reserve note, and why the silver was taken out of quarters and dimes and halves, and why the old $20 gold pieces were no longer available in exchange for a $20 bill. And it's a fascinating field of study. It's studded with the word of art and color of law. Under the preponderance of the law, or under the appearance of the law, we could all agree that the sky is blue or that it's green. And as long as everyone agrees, well, then that's the law. And certainly the same is true for money. It's a fascinating subject. That's how I came to study it, through the coinage laws and the differences between $20 bills and $20 gold pieces. And over the years, I've accumulated knowledge that an economist really wouldn't have. It's of a different field. They're more concerned with the economics of a particular system, whereas I'm right into the fine mechanics of what is the actual money that we all exchange and take for granted.
Okay, and of course your book really deals with the history of money and how it evolved through the various stages, and I had never heard the story before about the sticks that they used for money in England for so many years.
Right.
And of course, basically, you define money as simply a medium of exchange. And
right.
And of course, then what do you exchange? And why don't you just give our listeners just a brief history of money from, a man is worth his salt, to the dollar, and then, of course, to at least to a solid monetary-backed system, and then how we've evolved into a fiat system, and now we have just a totally fiat money system where everything is regulated by our invisible rulers, and our market goes up, our market goes down, depending upon their whim.
Through the creation of debt. Yeah, that's the real key right there.
Right.
And that's pretty much what I've boiled it down to, is that money has been changed from a system of credit where you were pulling money out of the ground and you were getting credit for it. Effectively, labor went into removing gold and creating its and thereby creating its value. So a system was based on a fixed supply of something known and above the ground. So everybody was kind of competing for the same gold, and so naturally it rose in price. But our system today is based strictly upon debt. It doesn't require gold coming out of the ground, but rather the willingness of a person to go into debt, and then the willingness of a system to accept that debt. So I guess if we start with modern history and money, and we realize that our ancestors came to understand that gold, because of its principles, you know, it's almost indestructible, it's malleable, it's divisible, you can pound it out into a wafer-thin sheet that, you know, would cover forever, or you can string it into wire, and if you take 1/100th of it, it's worth the same as 100 parts of its identical self. It's just a fascinating metal. You can bury it in the ground and dig it up 50 years or 100 years later, and it looks exactly the same. You can sink it in salt water, etc. So gold was accepted as a means of storing your wealth. Because of its limited supply, you could have a known quantity of gold and know how much it was worth. And when our forefathers put our monetary system into focus, they used gold and silver as a measure. And because the supplies of gold and silver are known, you could say that a dollar equals 0.75 ounces of silver, or 3/4 of an ounce of silver. And then everyone would understand, okay, a dollar is 3/4 of an ounce of silver, and that much silver will buy me this much bread, or it will buy me this much paint. And they could certainly then use that information to plan their businesses and their lives.
And ordinarily, in the old days, why, a man would work for a full day for a silver dollar.
You know? Right. Well, a silver dollar will feed you for, you know, it'll feed your family.
Right.
It's a substantial portion of value. A silver dollar is 0.7734 ounces of silver.
Okay, and then of course, a dollar today, and the faith and credit of the United States government will get you a cup of coffee any place.
Right. Well, but that's because the dollar has lost its value, although the perception is that it is still 0.7734 ounces of silver, and at law it may be. The reality is that the folks that are charged with creating dollars are now not basing them on silver or gold that might exist above the ground, but are basing it on the ability of the government or to tax its people, plainly put.
And of course, what they've really done is to a planned program of inflation.
Oh, yeah,
they have taken the dollar that existed, say, in 1900. It's now worth probably 2 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the dollar that I knew in 1960 when I first went into medical practice is probably worth, 15, 20 cents now?
Yeah.
About 6 cents. So what they have done is, by inflation, they steal from the people, and especially from the older people.
Well, they transfer wealth.
Right. And, of course, it goes from weak hands to strong hands.
Right.
And, of course, by this system of monetary of monetization of debt, you have the ability of people to buy up, for instance, most of the great corporations or most of the great communications media, ABC, CBS, and NBC. It's all done with borrowed money created out of simply bank entries or created out of thin air.
That's a salient fact, because one of the things our forefathers realized in making gold and silver coin the tender and payment of debt, as it mentions in the Constitution, no state should make anything but gold or silver coin a tender and payment of debt. Why? Because no one person at the time controlled all the gold or silver, as was evidenced by the gold rush of the 1840s out west and of the 1830s in the south. And that spreading out, or that no one person being in control of money, is really what made this nation great. And what really was what killed us, as Thomas Jefferson was afraid of, were banks and the ability to issue currency without backing. Because as he indicated, they and the corporations that grew up around them would deprive the people of all property. And it's just as you described. the folks who are now in a position to regulate the supply of money do it in this fashion. They do it by monetizing debt. So, in other words, if the Treasury has a bond for $1 billion, they present it to the Federal Reserve Bank, and the Federal Reserve Bank prints the money that is represented by that $1 billion bond, and exchanges an exchange takes place, and the bond bears interest. Whoever they decide to create that money for, in the case of Russia, they created money for Russia, $220 billion, and exchanged it for Russian Treasury bonds, MinFins they call them, Ministry of Finance bonds. That's how that $220 billion in large part got over there.
Okay, fine. And so, of course, those are redeemable in Russian currency or in American currency?
No, they're redeemable in dollars.
They are redeemable in dollars, assuming that the Russians will pay their debt. Now, they haven't paid most of their debt through the years, so what makes them think that giving them another $220 billion, they're going to pay this debt?
Well, because that beauty of rollover is what the banker understands. Let's go back and look at the goldsmith. See, the goldsmith loaned out gold in the beginning. So someone came and deposited 100 ounces of gold with him. He issued that person a note for 100 ounces of gold. That person left. He realized he could loan out 80 ounces of gold and be at pretty good risk that the first person wouldn't come back to get the gold. But after a while, after losing the gold several times, he realized quickly that if he simply printed the notes for the gold and loaned those out instead, if he lost those, then he wouldn't be in as bad a position as if he would have lost the 80 ounces of gold that they represented. So in the case of the notes for the Russian Ministry of Finance bonds, once the money is created to buy those bonds, then how that money escapes back into the system is irrelevant to the Federal Reserve. Even whether the bonds are ever paid off is irrelevant to the Federal Reserve. It is no longer an issue. Because the money has been created and sent into circulation, the damage is done, so to speak, and no amount of Russian payback is going to alleviate that problem.
And, of course, you know, the amazing thing, I can remember, in 1968, there was about $38 billion of currency in circulation.
In circulation, right.
Right. And today, your figure, last time I had looked, it was well over $400 billion. You say that it's over $500 billion money in circulation at the present time?
That's right. And I've tried to pin these guys at these jokers, I call them, at the Fed. Tried to pin them down so many times. They're so elusive over there, you know, and evasive.
And they
don't want to include certain things. Like, well, we don't include the money that's circulating in Russia when we give you that figure when they say over $400 billion in circulation. Okay. You don't include what's in Russia. Well, what's the total supply of printed currency? See, that's the only number, as far as I'm concerned, that makes any difference at all. And best I can pin that number down is something like $780 billion.
Really? Well, of course, it is backed by the faith and credit in the United States government, and the Russians have that confidence in the American dollar that they don't have in their own currency, because twice within the last, couple of decades, they've seen the value of their money totally destroyed by inflation.
But here's the problem. See, these guys that are getting their hands on this money are sending it back into the United States. And, you know, ultimately, let's not forget that that's the only place it's really any good. And the Russians are starting to enjoy this capitalist lifestyle, you know, the villas in Cannes and the vacations on the Riviera, and they love those Bronco-type automobiles, you know. So they're spending their dollars. That's the problem. And as the Federal Reserve Bank so rightfully realized, I think the last figure I got from them showed $97 billion domestically in normal circulation channels. So that's talking about all the money that is in supermarkets and is in transit right now that they can account for in the domestic economy. It's just $97 billion. Now, the rest of it is under mattresses and in safety deposit boxes and in Russia. And with any accumulated block of currency, as any stock player out there would understand, you run the risk when one person accumulates a great deal of your current debt. And the difference between $100 bills, which is what the Russians hold, and 90-day bonds or bills or even treasury bonds or notes, is that they're instantly good. You don't need to ask someone's permission to cash them or rely on someone's honor. They're instantly good, so that means that the Russians effectively hold a 2.5 time the domestic circulating money supply bomb,
and of course,
missile, you know.
And of course, this is why things are doing so well over in, you know, in Eastern Europe and
sure.
in Russia, is because we've given this tremendous infusion of dollars. And of course, this
bill.
Is one reason why things are doing so well in Mexico and other areas throughout the world, certainly in China today. And it's all this massive infusion of American money.
But it's got to come back home.
Oh, of course it does. And when it comes back home, that is the destruction of American monetary system.
Exactly.
And people don't understand that. What you have, and one of the nice things about your book, you talk about M1, you talk about M2, and you talk about M3.
Yeah.
And of course, these are monetary increments that the economists talk about, and then what they do is, so that nobody will really understand them, they keep changing the definition.
Right.
And 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I understood M1, M2, and M3.
Right.
I think they've changed the definition two or three times since then.
Sure.
Do you want to explain to our listeners what these monetary increments stand for, what they denote? Because, you know, at least I want our listeners to have some idea what they're talking about when they use these vague terms.
I don't really like to participate in those. In those arguments, because I think that M1, M2, M3 stuff is really an attempt to confuse people.
I agree with you. It's totally
in
every way.
But basically, think of it as in two terms. You have money that is being spent or is spendable right now.
That's M1, money in circulation.
Right.
Cash,
money
cash
that
money.
Is spendable at some short-term point in the future.
Right.
3 months, 6 months, 30 days, 1 year.
Checking accounts, drafts, cash money, and money in circulation, right.
Right. And then there's money that is not due for 10 or 20 or 30 years. But again, economists get together, and as you point out, they still can't agree on what belongs in that category. I mean, do you count corporate CDs or corporate deposits or commercial paper? Now, do you count euro dollars in there? You know, what do you count? Do you count money in Russia? Where do you count that? So because they're always changing the figures, what's really important to note here is that supply, that portion of the money supply that is not current money, let's just say anything that's greater than 1 year, has been ballooning since 1950. And whereas in 1950, that portion of money was 3%, today it's 73%. You know, it's gone completely the other way, and the entire nation is built on IOUs. And people expecting that at some point 30 years hence or 10 years hence or 20 years hence, they're going to be getting fixed amounts of money that will buy their way. And the only way that the scheme can work is if you add zeros to the money supply.
And of course,
that's the only way that it can work. The only way that you can pay every person right now who thinks they're a millionaire when they retire with their IRA. And you remember in the 80s, those commercials were, if you put $2,000 a year, starting in 1981, by the year 2010, you'll be a millionaire. Yeah, great. There'll be millionaires everywhere. You know, you'll be stumbling over millionaires.
Yeah, but it could chase you $1 million to, you know, get a loaf of bread.
Well, it'll be $1 million for a new Lincoln.
Right.
You know, I'll tell you, you probably pay $1 million. I guess I don't know what they are now. 50,000. Okay, maybe 500,000 for, you know, a top of the line automobile and a typical 3-bedroom ranch, probably, you know, $1.5 million or $2 million. And we'll sit around like, old folks, talking about how we used to work all week for $500.
Well, of course, Andrew, you're not looking ahead, because what's going to happen, and as you point out in your book so well, that according to Bill Clinton's own estimates,
right.
By, you know, the next generation will be paying 82%.
Yep.
Of their lifetime earnings in taxes. Now,
those
are the government figures. 82% of their lifetime figures in taxes. In Zaire, one of the reasons that the whole economy collapsed is because the government was taking 60% of the income of the natives there. They were making $2,000 a year, and the government was taxing them $1,200. That only left them with $800, and by the time they got through with the value-added tax of about 6 or 8%, and then another tax of 30%, you know, people just said, why bother to work? How many of our young people do you really think are going to be willing to work when they're paying 82% of all the money they make into the government to support older people like you and me.
Well, not only to do that, but to pay the interest on the debt that was created, from a generation that didn't want to deal with the problem.
Right.
So between the two, between interest on the debt and entitlements, you're right, that's 97% of the money. They'll have 3 cents if they'll slash every other public service that they are giving themselves. And having to pay the 82% tax burden, I don't see it. What I see is riot. And what they will do is what we did. They'll say, okay, well, we're just going to issue a bunch of 30-year bonds and make our kids and grandkids worry about it. And then we're going to take these 30-year bonds and hand them over to the Fed and let the Fed monetize them. And sure, it'll be inflationary, but that's a hell of a lot better than 82%. You cannot tax a people 82%, as you point out, rightfully so. You have revolutions, riots, and underground economies. So what you do instead is you just squeeze them as hard as you can, and you inflate the rest of the way, and you create that natural spillway dam that will, it'll keep working family, two wage earner family well into the 21st century, and probably that first child, will have to stay behind and work a couple years before they can leave the nest. So intergenerationally, it's very bad because our kids and our grandkids will resent us. I don't know how many workers out there today in the 30 to 50 year old range resent the people who are retired and on Social Security now. And every time they look at that contribution that they make, do they get angry? And I'm sure that it has a certain effect on them. It really is bad. If we could all just take care of ourselves instead of relying on the government to take care of us, then we'd be better off.
Well, it used to be that, they had six people working for every person
retired,
right, and then five, four. I think it's about two or three now. But another 20 years from now, it's going to be one person working for every person retired.
That's right. And I think inflation is built, as you said, built into the system, and that, it could be hyperinflation, but I think that hyperinflation is like killing the golden goose. John Maynard Keynes put it best, this seems so clear and obvious to those who study the issue, but Keynes said that those of us who understand it will simply profit by it, and we'll be so enamored with the profits that we'll eventually keep our mouths shut and go along, and that the rest of the folks, they won't understand it. They won't understand where the problem comes from. I remember, and then I think of Jerry Ford with his whip inflation now button.
Right.
As though he didn't understand that inflation was caused by the Federal Reserve and an increase in the money supply. He was suggesting, as Jimmy Carter was perhaps, that the best way to deal with inflation was to lower the thermostat. This type of fooling of the public is just indicative of what the average American thinks in terms of money. If they can't recognize that inflation is plainly and purposefully caused, then they really need to study money. And that's the issue of my book. And I think that if folks will get something like it and read it, they'll be amazed by what they discover.
Well, I think that we're going to tell our listeners how they can get hold of you and get hold of this book, because you need to understand that they're playing games with us. If you're out there in the listening audience, you must understand that you are the patsy. You're the fellow who's been gotten into the shell game.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course,
the Ponzi scheme.
Call it what you will.
Ponzi was a piker compared to this thing. That's Colonel Archibald Roberts said that, and I think he hit it right on the head.
Right. Well, Arch Roberts is certainly a great patriot, and he understands the Federal Reserve System, and he understands this is one of the greatest scams of all time. Let me tell you what Thomas Jefferson said many years ago. This is taken from the master thoughts of Thomas Jefferson. Everything predicted by the enemies of banks in the beginning is now coming to pass. Mm-hmm. We are to be ruined now by the deluge of bank paper, as we were formerly by the old continental paper. It's cruel that such revolutions and private fortunes should be at the mercy of avaricious adventurers who, instead of employing their capital, if any they have, in manufacturing and commerce and in other useful pursuits, make it an instrument to burden all the interchanges of property with their swindling profits which are the price of no useful industry of theirs. Prudent men must be on their guard in this game of robins alive, and take care that the spark does not extinguish in their hands. And, of course, he wrote that just 4 years before the whole economy collapsed.
Mm.
And, of course, we have this tremendous, inflationary economy, but you go back and you actually lay out the history of banking And, of course, why don't you maybe just briefly take us through when America was created, the central bank we had, and then how they were going to do away with the central bank because it was being used to exploit people, and
sure.
And then the wars and Jackson.
Right, the
and
wars
go ahead
followed.
And just pick this whole story up because it's a very important part of our history that is never taught in schools today. In other words, in fact, I'll never forget talking to my grandson and about the presidents. He said, oh, probably the worst one was Andrew Jackson. You know, he killed a lot of Indians and he made a lot of money speculating on land. And then, he got in the presidency and cheated everybody. And I said, Andrew Jackson was one of our greatest presidents.
Yeah.
What are they teaching you in school? And of course, that's what they've done. It's like the ridiculing of Calvin Coolidge, one of our greatest presidents.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead. Why don't you tell the story? I think we can get most of it in before our mid-hour break.
Yeah, I'll run it loosely. Bank of England won the war. And I'm speaking here of the Revolutionary War. The idea of a fiat currency was one of the things that caused the revolution. The idea that the colonists could not issue their own money and thereby prosper, that they had to use the money that was fully taxed and issued by the Bank of England, which had already created a monopoly power in England for all note issue. They had it as early as 1694. So they were well familiar, as you just elucidated with Thomas Jefferson's words, on the impact of non-backed currency and its effect on the economy and the ability of the issuers of that currency to buy up critical property. Well, we were fortunate to have placed into our Constitution no state should make anything but gold or silver, but as Madison noted, a victory was clenched defeat was clenched from the jaws of victory in terms of our ability to emit bills of credit ourselves as a government. Now, that was a critical phrase that was deleted from the Articles of Confederation. So the federal government no longer had the ability to emit bills of credit. And it was assumed that because that right wasn't given to the federal government, that it was reserved to the states and to the people. But in effect, that wasn't challenged. And Alexander Hamilton, who I believe was a traitor from the beginning, was in fact a secret agent, if you will, intent on chartering the first bank of the United States, similar to the Bank of England, held by private stockholders. And that was his whole intent on being on the scene. It's cynical to say that, I know, but in the end, he and his followers profited most handsomely by their granting, or the Congress's granting them a charter to establish the first bank of the United States, a bank with issue power, the power to issue notes, a monopoly power. And they held this charter for 20 years. And in the 20 years that ensued, you could look at some of the great industrial cities of the Northeast, and their fingerprints are all over towns like Paterson, New Jersey, named after William Paterson, the first president of the Bank of England. And in this town, they employed this money that they created out of thin air to buy all the critical iron works and necessary engines of manufacture.
And, you know, it really is a great scam. If you can just create money out of nothing, then you can buy up whatever you want to.
That's
and
right.
Everybody thinks it's real money because that's what everybody's accepting, and they don't realize it's a scam.
That's right. But the people in Congress realize, because after all, the folks who were owning the Bank of the United States were, in fact, the persons that were prospering the most and doing the least work. And so it was very easy for those folks who paid attention to such things to identify the perpetrators. And Congress wisely in 1812, now that's 20 years after the charter was first issued, they wisely chose not to renew that charter. Now, I never understood the War of 1812 when I was in school. I never understood what it was about, why the British were harassing our ships or our industry when we were allegedly at peace with them. But now I understand why. It had nothing to do with impressing seamen or shipping being harassed. It was plainly and simply that we had canceled the most lucrative charter issued in the world.
I'm going to have to interrupt you right here because we're going to have to take our mid-program break. Hang on there, will you please?
Yes.
But money is simply a part of this. We're really involved in a spiritual battle. It's being fought on a monetary battlefield, not a banking battlefield. The spiritual battle is being fought in the halls of Congress, in our courts, in our schools. It's being fought within the media. Most people don't even know the battle is going on. But this is the battle for the survival of Judeo-Christian civilization. But you have to understand the monetary aspects of this if you are have any hope at all of surviving, because if you really think that you're going to have a pension when you retire, you know, there are more young people who believe in UFOs that actually believe in the fact there's going to be any money left in Social Security when they retire. And those are smart kids, you know, who are questioning certainly the what they're being told, because this system just will not continue to work. It's going to fall apart. The only question is not if, but when. And, of course, then if you'd like to help us get this message out across America, why, we'd love to hear from you. Our address, Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063, or call us at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And for a gift of $20 or more a month, we'll send you the four best tapes of the month and encourage you to copy those tapes and help us to get this message out across America. Now, this program will probably be heard, this specific program will be heard back in New York. It'll be heard in Florida. But if you could help us to get this message from all across America, people are going to begin to question what they're learning through the media, begin to question what they're really learning in universities, because they're not teaching the truth. They're teaching the official party line. The purpose of education today is not to reveal, but to conceal the truth from our young people. And without knowledge, my people perish. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, the telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We are at war today, and we'd love to hear from you. I hope that you will join with us and with your neighbors in joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Okay, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. And, of course, right now I want you to tell our listeners how they can get copies of your book, The Secret World of Money.
If you'd like to get a copy of that book or a sample of my newsletter, you can call me at 800-468-2646. That's 800-468-2646.
All right, fine. That's 800-468-2646.
And, right.
I'm sure Kevin has that number. You can call in here at the station at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY if you didn't get the number, and we'll give it again before we're done. And so we'll open up the lines if anybody would like to call in here at 464-8295 or at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But why don't you go ahead with this story? You were telling us about the background of money and how, first of all, they created a central bank that allowed the people to create money out of nothing and begin buying up the industrial capacity of our young republic.
That's right. And every time the Treasury struck a silver dollar, Alexander Hamilton's Bank of the United States would create a paper dollar and buy that silver dollar. And it was a terrible situation. As a matter of fact, the coinage of silver dollars ceased in 1804, which is, again, one of the areas of study that I went into. Why did the 1804 dollar become so rare? Why is it worth $1.5 million today? And the answer is that I understand it's an economics principle that good money is driven out by bad money. And since all of this paper was circulating, the actual gold and silver coin of the Republic all but disappeared into people's drawers and nightstands and into the banks and coffers of those that issued the notes.
And, of course, that's Gresham's Law.
That's Gresham's Law.
Okay,
yes. And it's happened before. It wasn't new to our Republic. And those in Congress wisely understood money and recognized what was happening. And so they canceled the charter in 1812. And, again, we went to war with the British.
But I think the important thing that you bring out is that this war was in part manipulated simply as a means of punishing America for daring to cut the ties with the whole international banking system. Because this is international. This is not America. The central banks of the world today work together, and back in 1812, they worked very closely together as well.
It goes further than that. It's my firm belief that the Bank of England and the folks behind the Bank of England concocted an organization that dominated the world and dominates it to this day. It's how come England now is the only nation in Europe that can opt out of this Maastricht Treaty, if they so desire, and the monetary portion thereof. They are firmly and completely in control. I do not believe in the dissolution of the British Empire. I believe that once they knew that they controlled the banking industry within a particular country, then it didn't matter who made the laws. And so you saw these dominions spun off like Canada and various other provinces, that it was no longer necessary to maintain governmental control because you had control of the monetary system. And I think that the United States, believe it or not, was the first experiment in that grand design. Hello. And it worked. And when the British had to come back in 1812 to enforce that unspoken province, they did. And when Congress capitulated, even after the British had sacked Washington, and decided to renew this bank charter, I'm sure that deal was struck in private behind closed doors, and then the British retreated from a conquered foreign capital with right. no ill ramifications of any sort. I mean, you would think they would have taken the United States over again.
Well, let me just point out that for the skeptic out there, we carry a book written by Bill Clinton's mentor, Professor Carol Quigley, the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. It was so good that the publisher actually destroyed the place to the first half of the book so it couldn't be circulated, and you won't get this through your regular channels. You certainly won't find it in most public libraries. Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. But on page 324, Professor Quigley states what he told his students, like Bill Clinton, and that is that these central banks work together in concert to create a feudalistic system by which they can control the governments of the world. Those are Professor Quigley's words, page 324 of Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. So if you want to check that out, of course, we'll tell you later. You can call our 800 number if you're interested in knowing how to, you can get a copy of that book. But it's so vitally important that people understand that what Andrew is saying is absolutely true, that there is this central banking control. People sort of say, well, you think there's a conspiracy. No, I think that it's the cleverest scam ever created. And the fact that you've never heard of it shows the degree of control that exists over what the American people think. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would wonder, what is a conspiracy, you know? What is it? A conspiracy is when folks get together and act in concert.
Right.
And in this case, that certainly is what's happening. This meeting going on right now in Denver should prove it to everyone.
Well, you know, I wasn't invited again, but go ahead. But anyway, so now it's 1812, I guess it's about 1815.
1816 now.
Right, and now we've got a wonderful new...
You renew the charter for the Second Bank of the United States.
And it's a 20-year charter, and it's going to expire about 1835, 1836, somewhere there?
36, yeah.
Right.
Along comes Andrew Jackson. In his first term, he was an enemy of the bank.
Right, and he was. That's why he's vilified by all the historians now. Why you can go into universities and they'll tell you what a terrible president he was, and yet everybody admired Jackson because he had the courage to stand up to these people, even though there were a number of I've heard a number of unsuccessful attempts on his life.
Assassination attempts. Right. Well, early on, he was engaged in a feud over his departed wife Rachel's honor. And certainly that may lead to the rumors of his assassination attempts. It was clear to everyone at the time, and probably everyone now, that it was a war between Andrew Jackson and the Second Bank of the United States. Everything about it was, he called them a den of vipers in public. It wasn't a behind-closed-doors battle. It was a wide-open public battle. And in fact, many historians attribute the excess of pressure brought to bear by Nicholas Biddle and the Second Bank of the United States. He was the president of it. And the pressure brought to bear was so great that the public actually for a moment realized that what Andrew Jackson was saying was in fact true.
In fact, didn't Biddle actually collapse the American economy in retaliation for Jackson daring to say that he was going to control the bank? Right.
That's right. The hard times, satirized in a series of tokens called hard times tokens, another fascinating field of study that when I encountered these things in my numismatic travels, I said, what is this? A token that says millions for defense and not 1 cent for tribute. What's that all about? And tribute at the time, of course, was the money being paid to the folks in England. And the the people were saying that they would rather spend millions to defend themselves than to spend 1 cent in tribute to those that issued money.
Right.
And Andrew Jackson's war was a public war. It was a war between him and the bank. Nothing like it has ever happened in this country, and the closest thing that ever came to it since was John Kennedy's failed attempt to restrain or reissue United States notes. This was probably the closest thing to that, and it was semi-public. Many people don't even know of his effort, but Andrew Jackson's effort was public, open. As a matter of fact, he said, if you want this bank, then don't vote for me. Because if you vote for me, I will kill this bank. Can you imagine a candidate running today on that platform? If you vote for me, I will cancel the charter of the Federal Reserve Bank.
I think there was a fellow named Charles Collin who said that. And, of course, he got the total conspiracy of silence from every newspaper and just about every radio station in America. A few radio stations would let him on and let him tell the truth. But, you know, you start talking about banking, they are going to silence you.
Indeed. Your message will be ridiculed and laughed at by that establishment media that long ago was purchased with the notes that were issued by the creature. Edward Griffith called it the creature from Jekyll Island, and I think that's it's a pretty good assimilation. Many have asked me in the past, what is the Federal Reserve banking system? You know, is it a privately owned corporation? Is it a cartel? Is it a series of, is it indeed federal? You know, these types of questions. And I think that Mr. Griffith hit it right on the head. It is a creature. It's a creature of statute, and statute can decreate it. So we should, I think, educate the folks, let folks understand what the evils of a banking system based on debt are, and then look at history. Santayana hit it right on the head. Those that fail to study history are doomed to repeat it. You know, let's drag out and see what happened to the Holy Roman Empire there, and what caused their failure. You'll see it was a debasement of the currency, and every other fiat currency in the history of the world has failed, so why should ours be any different?
Well, of course, they think they're going to be able to pull it off because they're going to be able to control the people, and they're going to be able to continue expanding this, and as we expand the economies of the rest of the world, and really so much of it is being based on American currency, or at least related to American currency. And then as they lower the value of American dollars so that we can increase our exports, and then raise the value so that Japan can get their exports into the United States, and it's all controlled, and people aren't smart enough to see that.
Yeah, and they should be, because you know, and they're talking now, what's going to happen if the Federal Reserve banks raise interest rates? Okay, well, why would they raise interest rates? They would raise interest rates if they saw the jobless rate fall below 5%.
No. Wait a minute. If they saw it fall below 5% and they raised interest rates, they would actually make it fall even... I see. Okay, you're right.
Then they would throw people out of work.
Okay, fine.
And the very cynical nature of such a conclusion, of, you know, looking at a situation like that and realizing that the Federal Reserve would look at everyone working or fewer than 5% of the people looking for a job as a bad thing.
Right.
You know, this is publicly admitted. You ask any economist, what would happen if the unemployment rate fell to 4.5%? Would the Federal Reserve raise interest rates? You bet they would. They'd be cranking interest rates. You know, if it all of a sudden came in a surprise from 5.5% unemployment to 4.3% unemployment, they would absolutely go berserk. And they would start ratcheting interest rates northward because inflation would be imminent. No way to get around it now with that few people working, wage inflation, the root cause of it all, people actually making too much money and spending that money to take care of themselves. That's a very bad thing. That should indicate the level of control that they're confident they have. Never mind what other people tell you they have control. Look at the control that they demonstrate and willingly talk about. And that right there. Why would they raise interest rates? If the economy was doing too well. Can you imagine such nonsense? We're producing too much. That's absurd. That entire notion is absurd, and the idea of a managed economy is absurd. The free market will operate if you leave it alone. And I think that's been proven many times before. This notion of macroeconomics, I think, is a bunch of hogwash because you cannot predict what people will do given control over a free currency. And that right there is the key to the plan of the Fabian socialists or the socialist Fabians, and that is control, complete control over all money. So there's no cash in folks' hands. They're simply trading electronic blips in currency. And if that system ever comes to pass and is full-blown in nature, well, then the circle of control will be complete. And in that case, I'll reevaluate my thinking. But until then, I think that we have a chance as Americans to get our hands on this problem and do something about it.
But, of course, what they want, really want is a dictatorship where there is no money. Everything
right.
will be an electronic entry,
yeah.
and they will control the entries.
That's right.
And that's
and,
exactly
and the
where
withdrawal
we're headed.
Report.
And there are a lot of people think, well, that's not so bad, as long as times are good, and, you know, I've got my beer and Monday night football, what's wrong with it?
Well, it's easy to enforce that 82% tax burden when, you know, you have to log into the system in order to get a job, and your payments have to come through such a system. It's easy to take the tax right at the source.
Sure, and of course, once you've disarmed the people have nothing to do but go along with it. You know, in other countries, they call that slavery. Now, I think one of your most intriguing ideas, Andrew, was this idea of a debt-free currency based upon various projects. And when I first read that, I said, that sounds crazy, and that's going to be inflationary. And as I read your thoughts on that, I said, that's ingenious. Why didn't I think of that?
Well,
why don't you explain that to our listeners?
Well, it's not so much, you know, I don't want to get on that debt-free bandwagon because it still represents debt. It's more, the more appropriate way to term it would be interest-free. And interest, you know, rarely contributes to a project. If we could just find a way to remove the corruption from these projects, we would have both problems solved. Between corruption and interest, public works projects cost 3 and 4 times what they should. The reality is basically if we all got together and decided that we wanted to build a pick an item, a great dam or a highway from coast to coast, and we agreed on how we were going to pay for this road, be it through road taxes or through a toll, then we would issue directly the notes associated with that project. You know, if it takes $1 billion to build this thing, then you print 1 billion red $1 bills, and you make them good for payment in taxes. You simply make them receivable in taxes. And what was done in colonial times was you discount taxes if they're paid with these things. You know, if you discounted taxes 1% even, or half of 1%, I bet that you would have a whole system of brokers springing up to turn these notes into more readily spendable money. But I think that the half of a percent would be enough to convince anyone to take these notes and store them until their taxes are due and then use them to pay their taxes. That system of finance is much less expensive than sending a bond for $1 billion into the market at 7%.
Sure.
And it would result in the project being completed with no leeching, no money lost to folks who have no contribution to the project, but merely handling the affairs or the sale of the debt.
All right, now, but see, the problem, at least theoretically, is now we've got $1 billion in circulation we didn't have before, so that's inflationary.
Well, yeah, but the secret is that no matter how you finance that project, whether you finance it with a bond or whether you finance it with these notes, that end result is going to be the same. Anytime a government undertakes a project in which they do not have the money, by its very nature, it's inflationary. That is not necessarily a bad thing if you define inflation in its proper format and don't use what the economists call inflation, which is the consumer price index. That's an absurd notion. Certainly, a growing monetary base is good as long as that growing monetary base is relative to an infrastructure base or some type of a real physical base. The whole key to these types of projects is to put the money into something that is useful and that is going to generate revenue.
And that's the key. It generates revenue, and then you use that revenue to buy back the notes.
Exactly.
And that is the genius of this, because that way it's not inflationary. You have your highway from coast to coast now. It's generating money. It will continue generating money, and the people who are using it are going to have to pay for it.
That's right, and that creates an additional demand. See, you can't automatically equate an increasing money supply with inflation unless you factor in the increase in production that the expansion provided.
Right.
And you know, I don't see that. I don't see that when I see economists talk about something like an issue of this nature and predict inflation as the end result. That's absurd. That's an absurd notion. It's an increase in production. Now, if you take the money and you build a monument to Art Linkletter, you know, as great as art was, I don't think it'll support itself. Or if you give it to the Russians, you know, I don't think that the Russians are going to help us enough to make that support itself.
How about the NEA?
No, I don't think the NEA could help us either here.
And so basically what you're suggesting is you can actually, government can create money.
Yes.
But they create it to pay for something of intrinsic value.
Yeah, Hoover
that will
Dam.
Generate funds down the line. And really,
absolutely.
If you stop and think about this, and then, of course, as the time goes by and they collect more money, they pay it off. Of course, you've got to have honest politicians to do that.
Yeah.
But then you haven't actually expanded the monetary supply, you know, other than very, very, very temporarily. And you have to expand the monetary supply a little bit. You've just got to... control how it's done.
And you expand it proportionately right. to the increase in production or proportionate to GDP.
Right, and of course, this is what the Fed is doing, but the trouble is that somebody's collecting an awful lot of interest on all the new money that they create. In other words, it's a debt-based currency, and you're talking right today at, what, 6%? You're talking about over $300 billion we're just paying in interest on this debt, and that $300 billion does nothing at all. It is totally wasted money. In other words, it's money that they take from every man, woman, and child in America to pay the debt on the money that's already been spent.
A good point. And if you slashed this portion, this interest portion of the budget to zero, you could virtually eliminate the individual income tax. And you know, think about what a boost in productivity that would give in terms of American spending. But the insidious truth of it all, and I don't think that you'll find a politician or let alone an economist that will admit this to you, is that more than anything, taxes are a method of controlling inflation. It's not really about having money for the government to spend. It's about controlling inflation. And the higher you raise taxes, the less individuals have money to spend. Clear example of that should be that the current budget deal has a provision in it that calls for not spending any money from a trust fund, a highway trust fund or an airport trust fund, even though we're paying into it each week in the form of gas taxes, and those numbers are horrendously huge. The amount of money paid into the government's coffers in gas taxes, allegedly to improve our roads. So now they decide to simply borrow that money out, spend it into circulation for their programs, whatever programs they want, and then make an arrangement never to spend that money to fix any highways, thereby reducing inflation. That's what taxes are used for now, and it's a very, very insidious plot. Unless we recognize what is going on, we're not going to be able to take steps to protect ourselves.
You know, Jimmy Baker was put in prison. I think they gave him 40 years initially for spending money from a trust fund
right.
when that money was not authorized for that use.
Right.
And yet our Congress has been doing that. And that then the debt that's incurred from the highway trust fund, from the airport trust fund, and all these things, that money is spent on non-highways, non-airports, and is added to the but it's not added to the national debt.
Yeah, well, see, that's the real key in that whole
right.
equation, and that is, as long as the money is still sitting there in the form of treasury bonds, as long as it's not, the bonds aren't cashed and the actual roads repaired, then it won't cause any inflation. And each week, it's actually reducing the spendable supply of money by the amount that we pay in gas taxes. You know, if we didn't pay that in gas taxes, we'd be spending it at Burger King, and it would be immediately into circulation. But by taking it, running it through this gas trust fund, highway trust fund, letting the trust fund grow, and then borrowing the money out of the trust fund, you keep a check on inflation, and at the same time, you get to promote all of the projects that the people would not necessarily pay taxes for. You know, you wouldn't necessarily take whatever you're paying in gas taxes to finance a revolution in Zaire, or to police developments in Bosnia. But you would certainly pay it to fix your roads, and that's how they do it.
Oh, it's really so clever, and yet the average individual doesn't understand why they don't want to really cut the capital gains tax significantly.
Right.
You know, and they keep saying, you know, oh, the Democrats keep saying, oh, that all those rich people, they've made all this money in the stock market, and it's only going to benefit the rich. Well, you know, I think the average person would benefit from a cut in capital gains. What they really don't want is for the average person to benefit.
You
make money in your stock market, you're going to end up paying top bracket, you know, by the time you get through with your federal and state tax, you know, at least a third of it. And, you know, of course, they're going to do everything they can to make sure that the people don't get their share But the politicians get their goodies because they get their fat pensions. They get real good jobs. Our local congressman was, in fact, his name was Leon Panetta, and he, of course, left the government, and he got a job at one of the local colleges. I think it was something ridiculous, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars a day. Somebody could probably call in and tell me how much it was, but I can just tell you he's just not worth that amount of money.
No, he certainly isn't. And the link between academia and government, it's like a revolving door there.
Sure.
You know, you can't teach, or you can't do, you teach. And so you can't teach, you go and run government, it seems.
Well, of course, what they do is they reward those people who are dedicated to the socialist or statist philosophy. Andrew, we're just about out of time. I would love to get you back here sometime real soon. In fact, I'm going to be gone on vacation when I get back. I want to get you on our afternoon program.
Sure.
What number again to get the book is
1-800-468-2646.
That's 1-800-468-2646. It's an excellent a book. It's only about 140 pages, but a tremendous amount of knowledge and wisdom. It's written, it's an easy book to read, and it gives you, somebody once said, just the facts, ma'am. That's
right.
What it's got, just the facts. Why don't you just sort of wrap your thoughts up here in a minute or so?
Yeah, on the book, basically, I tried to create a text that you could start anywhere and stop anywhere, and most economic tombs will drive you to drink. You get, you know, a quarter of the way through the book and your eyes are all glared over and you just put it down and forget the whole subject. This one you can segment it and read it and learn in sections. I've taken it in a Q&A format. I think that's the best way to handle it, a question and then an answer. And that enables you to hop around and skim over things that you think you know the answer to or compare what you think the answer is to what it really is. It's the best that I could do, as certainly there are other books on the subject, but I think mine is pretty good. If you'd like to get it, give me a call. As to the general situation, I think that it should be clearly obvious to everyone that inflation is built into this system. Will Rogers said, bet on inflation, it's the only thing going up. The individual who has bought tangible items and then sold them at a later point in our own lifespan has done much better than the individual who put his money into bonds and was repaid with interest. So consider that going forward here. I think the worst investment you can make for the next 20 years are bonds, and the best investments will be tangible physical items.
Okay, and I think it was Ludwig von Mises who said bonds are certificates of guaranteed confiscation.
Yeah, certificates of depreciation.
Right. Thanks very much, Andrew. It's been a great, great hour, and I wish we had more time. But we will get you back here before very long. Once again, that number, 1-800-468-2646. Bye-bye, and thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
For this or other messages available at Radio Liberty, you can write Dr. Stan at P.O. Box 13, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. God bless.